Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy, a retired four-star general, 2004 presidential contender, author, and political commentator. Wesley Clark is now starting a nonpartisan organization. The goal of Renew America is to encourage people to find common ground by promoting public and political discourse. Wesley Clark joins us in our studio. General Clark, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us.
Nice to be here, Ann. Thank you.
You're in the process of starting this organization with the goal of bringing people together across party lines to start thinking about common challenges and solutions. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, because if you look at politics today, it's broken. It has disintegrated into deeper and deeper partisan divides where people, you can't even be friends with people in a different party in some respects. I mean, you just agree not to talk about things because what's happened is really this started in the 1980s, late 70s, maybe as a result of maybe it was Vietnam and Woodstock and maybe it was the abortion decision. But people found a way of sharpening the division between people to serve their personal and organizational interests. And so now you have you had value voters, they called it. They called it the moral majority. Then it was the Tea Party. But in fact, it's about people who they don't find compromise. They want imposition. And democracy is not, in the American system, is not designed to work that way. And if you look back at the history of this country, we've done some wonderful things, but almost all of them were accomplished by working together, not by dividing the country.
It sounds like a great idea, but it also seems like the type of thing that could appeal to the people who maybe need it the least. Are you concerned about how you're going to be able to reach across the party lines, reach across those ideological lines to get people
to
come together?
I'm concerned to reach across every line because I think you have to have people from every walk of life and every age group. I think you have people who are willing to learn the lessons of American history and look at it deeply. Yes, it's going to be hard to bring people who are on top. They're going to say, hey, we got our Supreme Court justice in. We're packing the courts. Oh, what do we care? But see, that's just the problem because in democracy, what goes around comes around. And when the tenor of the discussion turns brittle and people are angry with each other, it begets anger on the other side. This has happened before in this country on the issue of slavery, and it ended up in war. This is the 21st century. We're not going to go to war with each other, I hope, although we certainly have some foreign adversaries who'd love to see it. But the inability to work together across the aisle, it really hamstrings America's progress. Ronald Reagan said we were the shining city on the hill. Madeleine Albright said we were the indispensable power. People all over the world looked to us for an example. My friends in Eastern Europe who grew up under communism, when the Berlin Wall fell and they could have democracies, they looked to the United States. People in Asia want to look to the United States. People come here from China, and they think, why can't we have a society in China that has freedom of expression and works together? Why is it about authoritarian control, for example? People from Russia come here, and yet we're losing some of our luster because of things like voter suppression. My friends in Romania asked in 2012 where I was going. I said, well, I went to Ohio to work against voter suppression. They said, well, what's voter suppression? I said, well, it's, where you don't have early voting and you artificially narrow the requirements and you try to keep people away. He said, but in a democracy, don't you want everybody to vote? I said, you would think so.
In theory, that's what it's
and
about.
Yet, if you look at American history, it goes through 30 and 40-year cycles. They're strategic, cultural, political, economic. You have to understand where the country's been, and what we're trying to do with our organization is bring together a group of people, young people, middle-aged people, older people, people who want to address the real issues in society and get away from soundbite politics.
What would you say to the skeptics who say ruthlessness, bare-knuckles politics and fighting have always been a part of this country? And there's different examples you can point to when Senator Kerry was running and the so-called idea of getting swift-voted, or I'm thinking of Lyndon Johnson and his biographer has looked at allegations they were essentially stuffing the ballot boxes.
Yes, and sin has always been a part of human life, but it doesn't mean we extol it. the whole idea of democracy is not that your political opponents are enemies. You're not trying to destroy them. What you're trying to do is compete in the battle of ideas to do what's best for the country. At least that's the theory. Now, from the beginning, the Constitutional Convention writers and thinkers were worried about the problem of factions because they realized in every group, if you went back and looked at the history of democratic governance, and they had Greece and Rome to look at, but if you look at that, there were always factions, and the factions were selfish. And so they created a system of checks and balances in which one faction and one faction's ambitions and interests would be offset by the ambitions and interests of the other faction. They foresaw it. It doesn't mean it's pleasant, but the country's done best when it was united.
One of the political candidates who's running for U.S. House here, I spoke with him, and he said that politicians in Congress don't do a very good job about thinking about the long term. They're just thinking in the short term, how they can get elected, how they can meet that payoff. And it sounds similar to what you're saying. Or when you talk with people about this, are you hearing from people who say, yes, that's what we want to do?
Well, what I'm hearing is people don't like the short-term focus of the politicians. But if you let the politicians get away with it, that's what they'll focus on. Because, you know, when people are put in elective office, they don't make that much money by Wall Street standards. They do okay by the standards of middle America. You know, the average American makes $50,000 or so. So when a person makes $170,000 and the wife is complaining, well, my husband is worth, you know, hey, better be careful because most Americans don't make that much money. But they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it for the prestige, the influence, the chance to see a different aspect of life, curiosity in some cases. But once they get there, it becomes part of their personality. And they act as though the office is theirs personally. I've seen it. I know. I've been around politics for a lot of my adult life. And so if the American voter allows the politician to treat it as, you know, this is just about give me some more money and I'm sure you can have access to my office. If they let them get away with that, that's the way it'll degenerate. If the people in the rallies and in the meetings say, what's the long-term future of this country? What are we going to do about climate change? Are we going to put a carbon tax in? Is my Social Security going to be safe when I retire in 20 years? Is the Center for Disease Control going to be properly resourced, or are we going to be swept? Does America look like Mad Max and Road Warriors in 30 years because there's going to be 2,000 families that are worth hundreds of millions and billions of dollars, and most Americans are scratching out there trying to grow tomatoes and canned vegetables to survive and shoot things that move in the dark of night to eat? I mean, is that what we're going to? What's the future of the country? We want that dialogue in politics. These politicians are supposed to respond to that. Instead, they respond too often to special interest groups. They respond to the money.
How do you see your initiative changing that? So people come together, we'll have discussions. What would the next step be to make some concrete changes?
The next step is you go and you ask the questions. If you're up there, you got your hand up. I want to ask this question. You don't go in there and say, oh, I just wanted to meet him and he seems like a really decent guy, or I really like her. She's really cute and she seems like, that's not what this is about. This is about charting the future of the country. And if it's really under the control of the voter, people complain about money in politics. Yes. However, it's really about the votes that count. And the people that come together in this organization, if we do our jobs the right way, politicians won't be able to get away with serving the interests of the special interest group. They'll be held accountable. I'll give you an example of this. In the 2016 presidential campaign, I was with a group in Iowa promoting the use of ethanol. So we went to every candidate, said, are you in favor of ethanol or are you not in favor of ethanol? And you know what? Because we spoke up on this issue, as opposed to just being entertained and listening to them, we got commitments. And actually, President Trump was smart enough to say, you know what, I'm in support of ethanol. Now, in office, he sort of wiggled and wobbled on this because most of his money comes from the oil industry. But those pledges, if people want to talk long term and talk issues and get politicians on the record, it makes a difference. Mitch McConnell last week was ruminating on the possibility of, you know, the deficit's really high. And I mean, we might have to, you know, where the money goes in this country, it's, you know, there's entitlements and stuff. And we might have to take another boy. I mean, he heard a lot about that really quick. But do we have a pledge from every man in office and woman running for office that they're going to respect Social Security, that they're going to promote it, preserve it, enlarge it, take care of people? Because in this country, we have the greatest gap between the wealthy and the shrinking middle class and the working class that we've had since the Depression. We're worse than any other country in the developed world, so-called developed world, on this. Where is it headed? These are the kinds of questions that I hope our organization can bring to the fore in the political discussion. Not guns, but that's okay if you want to ask it. Not about public prayer in the school. Not about a woman's right to choose. Those are value issues. People have set views on those issues, and there's no compromise. There's no discussion. It's like a litmus test. Okay, I'm in favor of I'm pro-choice. Well, I'm pro-life. Okay, fine. But you're not going to get anywhere beyond that. Let's talk about the future of the country.
One of the issues you mentioned, climate change, and of course you're involved in Jeff Bridges' documentary, Living in the Future's Path. And you said in an interview that the film is an effort to awaken American public to what's happening with climate change. How did you get involved in that project?
They asked me.
And what are you hoping to see come out of it?
I hope people take it very seriously. I gave a speech at the Explorers Club about a month ago. And then 2 weeks ago, the UN panel on climate change produced, and I was really relieved the UN agreed with what I said in the speech. I didn't expect them to be so forthcoming, you know, because over the 30 years we've been looking at climate change issues, the UN panels are, they're like hand-wringing. Oh, we have to be careful. We're not sure about this. And look, it's as clear as it can be. We were trying to keep the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, carbon parts per million, below 450. Well, it's 408 right now and going up 3 a year. That says you have 14 years or less, and it's accelerating.
Right. There's a new report out that says a pretty grim outlook by 2040 of
exactly.
significant
exactly.
changes.
Exactly.
Right?
You know, there's never been a Greenland ice cap when there were more than 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. So that means it's just a question of time. And when that Greenland ice cap goes, Manhattan goes with it, South Florida goes with it, and about maybe 1.5 billion people around the world lose their homes. Does that happen in 50 years, 150 years, 500 years? We don't know. Those are issues that have to be worked. So it's not like you said, oh, okay, well, we're going to miss the target. Okay, that's it. Let's move on. The administration said, okay, well, it's going to be 7 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100. Okay, next question. I mean, that's not the way this is. It could be worse than 7 degrees. We have to help the American public see through this entertainment that news has become. Now, you're in the news business, and you know that this is Penn State, but for the most part, the news has to make money.
Newspapers do. I used to work at a newspaper, and newspapers do have to make money. This is public radio. It's a little bit of a different boat.
And it's gotten worse over the years. When publishers owned newspapers, and now a man like Patrick Soon-Shiong runs the LA Times, he doesn't care whether it makes a lot of money, if it says the right things maybe and provides a public service. But if you're part of a big organization, like NBC is part of a big organization, or CNN is part of a big organization, they got to make money. And so they have to, it's entertainment. The news is not presenting a common picture of the facts to the American people. It's really entertaining. It's a competition.
It is a changing landscape for newspapers.
And especially for TV and the media. Look, Rush Limbaugh had a monopoly on this as the first shock jock that came out. But Keith Olbermann tried to compete with him on MSNBC. We have Rachel Maddow now, and she's real smart. But the daily commentary fills up the airwaves, but it doesn't necessarily advance the political dialogue that needs to take place to move the country in the right direction. That dialogue has to take place by empowered, educated, determined people in the process of election campaigns. And a student at Penn State can have just as big an impact as the chairman of ExxonMobil if that student is there at the right time, asking the right questions, persistent, and follows up. We did this in Iowa in the 2016 presidential campaign with ethanol. We had farmers at every rally to talk about ethanol. Well, ethanol is a tiny part of the solution to climate change. There's so many big issues. We could use hundreds of thousands of young people who care about this country. Voting is not enough. You have to get the candidates on the record. You have to make them address the significant issues.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. We're talking with Wesley Clark, retired U.S. Army general, decorated war veteran, and political commentator.
Well, not actually, Ann. I'm not actually a political commentator. I'm a military commentator. I'm not there on CNN or Fox offering the latest chit-chat for what happened in Washington today. I know that's entertaining. I know those people make nice money. That's why they do it. But it's a game. I'm not in this for the game. I'm in this for my children and grandchildren. I'm in it for this country.
One thing that's been in the news is the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia. A reporter died in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, and there are serious allegations that the reporter was tortured and killed. When people say, why is this important to the United States, how do you answer that?
We fought two world wars in the 20th century to make sure that most of the world we deal with reflects American values. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in treating people with respect. We don't believe in arbitrary detention and murder. And the countries that we work with, we expect them to share those values. Now, we've always had an odd relationship with Saudi Arabia. They had oil. They weren't really a nation, really. I mean, if you go back and look at this, this is a tribe that Lawrence of Arabia helped to push out the Turks in the 1920s, basically. And they overran by force with the help of modern weaponry the other tribes on the Arabian Peninsula. They converted them to Wahhabism, or they cut their heads off. It was a brutal takeover. Then in the 1930s, an American company discovered oil, and Roosevelt cut a deal because we needed oil. But look, do you know today we're the largest oil producer in the world. So I think Saudi Arabia has to understand that we have a historic relationship. But the truth is that we can produce from the United States enough oil over the next 30 years to complete the destruction of the environment. We're loaded with oil. The Permian Basin has 5 or 10 times more oil than we've ever produced in the world. And we know how to get it out of the source rock now. I'm also in the oil and gas business. So the way you learn about America is, the way I learned about it is, of course, I was 38 years in uniform, but then I ran for office and I learned what politics is like. And then I've been with maybe 100 companies in business. And I'm in oil, gas, wind, solar, electric power, batteries. I'm in security, software. I'm in finance. I'm in infrastructure development. I work in Africa, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, China, South and Central America. I know from putting my hands on these companies how the world is. And so you see what, you don't see the whole truth. Nobody should think they ever have the whole truth. But I want to give back to this organization. I want to empower young people to ask the important questions. And it won't be just me. It'll be a lot of people like me who want to share with people who will go out and press the candidates hard. You don't get away with flip answers. You don't get away with sound bites. You're not going to get away with ridicule or cynicism. You're going to have to really come to before we vote. And if you don't have these answers, please get them. We want to know what you stand for, and then we're going to hold you to it.
Before retiring from the military in 2000, you served as the NATO Supreme Allied Commander, and you've questioned President Trump's approach and commitment to NATO And in some cases, his approach to international relations. When you're thinking about that, what concerns you the most?
Well, if you look at what's made America successful in the world, it's because Americans worked together and because Americans worked with allies, mostly people who shared our values more or less. If you look at the times that America has failed, it's when America was divided and when America cut off its relationship with its allies. So when a new president comes to office, there's always a learning curve. President Trump, very, very smart, very hardworking, very determined, came to office with a background in real estate. But he traveled abroad. He'd been in the New York scene. He knew diplomats. He knew what people from foreign governments said. And he had a special view of America. But he didn't have the full picture of America. So his idea of diplomacy seemed to be start at the personal level and then work downward. In some cases, it might work. But it also risks confusion, misunderstandings, and fracturing, destroying longstanding relationships. I travel in Europe and people constantly come up to me and tell me how upset they are with America because these countries depended on us. We helped them maintain their freedom in the Cold War. We helped the countries in Eastern Europe gain their democracies at the end of the Cold War. And now it's as though it's a real estate transaction. You're going to pay us or we're going to throw you out of the building. Really? I mean, that can't be the way America does business in the world and still have the influence that we need to protect our American way of life going forward. That's a return to a 19th century world in which nations jostle with each other, threaten each other, deploy their fleets against each other, and occasionally go to war with each other.
You had your own run for the Democratic nomination for president in 2004. What drew you to wanting to run for president?
Well, I saw the mistake the United States was making by going to war in Iraq. It was a huge mistake. It was done for political reasons. It was done for all the wrong reasons, and it was poorly done. I mean, all foreign policy reflects domestic policy. If it doesn't, it doesn't have any legitimacy. If foreign policy only reflects the financial interest of the President of the United States, it's not the right way to, you know, make foreign policy. You have to look at what makes something effective as well as what your motivations were. So after 9/11, the motivations were show the American people we're going to take care of them, be tough, be strong, and so forth. Look, there was no reason to go into Iraq to do that. And then, having done it, we didn't even look at what the end state was. Imagine. Can you imagine? We invade a country. We destroy its government. We don't even get them to sign a peace treaty or something with us. There's no one left to give us legitimacy. General Douglas MacArthur and Harry Truman knew in 1945 that even after we dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, you had to have a surrender ceremony. Someone had to remain in charge of the Japanese people. You didn't have a million Japanese-speaking American soldiers to stand on every street corner and maintain law and order. Well, that was the problem in Iraq, and look where it is today.
It sounds like you bring more of a historical and philosophical approach when you're looking at these military issues or international issues. Do you think that's something that's lacking in the current administration?
Well, certainly, but then I've had the leisure and the experience to do it.
Right now, various Democrats are warming up to announcing that they're going to consider running for president. Politically, do you still consider yourself a Democrat? And if you do, what do you think that party needs to do to start winning?
Well, I'm still registered as a Democrat, but the organization I'd like to create is a nonpartisan organization. So I hope we'll get some Republicans to join with me. There's a lot of Republicans who see the same issues. They may not agree on everything, like maybe they don't feel like the carbon tax should be $270 a ton. Maybe they think, maybe let's do the carbon tax in 5 years or something like this. But there are Republicans out there who have the same concerns. You know, the problem for the Democratic Party is that the two parties are not symmetrical. You know, it's not like you have two juggernauts smashing heads. The Republican Party has become a real party in the European sense of a parliamentary party. It has party discipline. You disagree with that Republican Party, they cut off your funding, they run someone against you, you don't step out of line. How do I know this? Because my wife worked as a volunteer for Texas Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison.
Okay, so firsthand experience.
So she knows what that party's like, and that was 23 years ago. It's much tougher today. On the other hand, the Democratic Party is, it's what Will Rogers said back in the 1920s. He said, I belong to no organized party. I'm a Democrat. And he was a great American comedian. But there was some truth to this, and there still is. Democrats span a wide variety of ideas, philosophies, and approaches. And there isn't, for the Democratic Party, a central mechanism that if a Democrat disagrees with party, so what? Look at this young woman who defeated this veteran Democratic congressman in New York, because that's her district. You know, he wasn't representative. He didn't get it. She did. Democrats are closer to the people, and they tend to be more, let's say, idea-based rather than value-based. And so what you have is one party that's motivated by fear. That's the Republican Party. They're always afraid of something. Now there's 7,000 immigrants coming in. Okay, oh, 7,000 immigrants. Okay, well, you know, the country has, this is 330 million people in this country. So I don't know, you know, what 7,000, mostly women and children, could do to us. But, you know, I'm really scared. And then on the other side, you've got the Democrats who are all about fairness. You know, you got to treat people right. There were these two people and they weren't treated fairly. And let's bring a lawsuit. You know, and so over the last 30 or 40 years, the parties have they've cleaved apart. On the Republican side is rural America, fundamentalist Christians, big business, people that like guns. And on the former people who, like for union members who used to vote Democratic, there's no unions anymore. And a lot of them are stuck in the Rust Belt without good jobs. On the Democratic side, you've got the traditional sort of minorities, lawyers. They're always good for a few $100,000 of contributions. Some Wall Street types. Wall Street's about 40% Democrat. You've got Jewish Americans who are concerned about people's rights. They know what it was like to have their rights denied and be abused during the Holocaust. And so still probably the majority of Jewish Americans would consider themselves Democrats. And you have some tech people. And it's a bi-coastal party versus what's in rural America. What I'd like to help people do is bring together an organization that empowers young people and people from every walk of life to have the right questions and to be reinforced in their struggles. It's not easy to get recognized in a political dialogue. And you might get thrown out. You might not get called on.
Sounds like you're saying, though, they stick with it, that they can
know what you believe in and demand that the politicians in this country work for the American people, not for special interests.
Wesley Clark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with retired four-star general Wesley Clark. His new organization, Renew America, aims to help people find common ground. To hear this and other Take Note interviews, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.